3,4-methylenedioxymethamphetamine. That's quite a mouthful. It's also known by its initials, MDMA, more popularly known as ecstasy. It's a drug that was first synthesized in the early 1900s in Germany. MDMA began to be used in psychotherapy in the 1970s, and then in 1985, the Drug Enforcement Administration banned it. They placed the drug into what's called Schedule 1. Schedule 1 substances, according to the DEA website, are, quote, drugs with no currently accepted medical use and a high potential for abuse. Schedule 1 drugs are the most dangerous drugs of all the drug schedules with potentially severe psychological or physical dependence, end quote. By the way, I should mention, marijuana is also a Schedule 1 drug. A number of therapists and researchers felt that the DEA was wrong, that the current schedule of drugs is based largely on misinformation, misunderstanding, and prejudice. One of those researchers who's been working for the past few decades to prove that MDMA is in fact a useful therapeutic drug is Rick Doblin. Rick received a doctorate in public policy from Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, where he wrote his dissertation on the regulation of the medical uses of psychedelics and marijuana. His professional goal is to help develop legal contexts for the beneficial uses of psychedelics and marijuana, primarily as prescription medicines, but also for personal growth for otherwise healthy people. Well, back in 1986, when I first met him, Rick founded an organization called the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. Another mouthful, MAPS for short. Ever since then, MAPS has led the way toward a greater understanding of psychedelics and other drugs, and it's my pleasure to have Rick as a guest today. Rick, how are you doing, man?
I'm doing pretty great, Doug, and you know, I'm very happy to be doing this with you because we've known each other for so long, and you know, there's very few people actually that know what it was like, you know, when we first met, the climate and how opposed it was to any kind of research with psychedelics or with marijuana. And so, you know, for us now to be looking at a time when change is in the air, when science is flourishing, there's more psychedelic research now than at any time in the last 45 years. You know, you can go to your corner store and buy marijuana there in Oregon, and it's going to be on the ballot here in Massachusetts in 2016. And hopefully it will pass. I think we're at a time of incredible cultural change. And so it's just really satisfying. And I'd say the biggest problem that I've got is that so much good stuff is happening, I can't keep up with it.
Oh, what a terrible situation to be in, eh? So, look, I gave the listeners a thumbnail biography of you and all this. Tell us more about MAPS and how you started the organization and why.
Well, let me go back just a little bit further. So I'll go back to when I was an 18-year-old, and I started college in 1971 when I was 17 at New College in Sarasota, Florida. It's now the Honors College of the state of Florida. And I had been growing up at a time of a lot of fears of the destruction of the world with nuclear arms race, with the Soviet Union, with the Cuban Missile Crisis. I grew up very aware of the Holocaust and World War II and, you know, distant relatives killed. And it just helped me to grow to appreciate the fact that psychological factors were really the crucial area for both human problems and potential human survival, that we had to solve a lot of these primitive kinds of thinking, of dehumanization, of projection, of mass murder, and that it would be psychological factors that were the most important, rather than kind of more classic, can we find enough food and shelter? Can those kind of survival questions, you know, science and agriculture had progressed, but it was whether, in a way, the scientific developments that were so advanced far beyond our emotional and spiritual capabilities, whether we could cope with that. You know, Albert Einstein said, our technology has exceeded our humanity. So at age 17 and almost turning into 18 is when I first tried LSD, and that was profound. And it felt like I was encountering this vast desert, you could say, of my emotions that I was pretty much incapable of feeling and of addressing. And psychedelics felt like a tool that could help bring me into balance. And this was, I was waking up to this right after the massive crackdown with the Controlled Substances Act in 1970 and the criminalization of all these drugs, and then Nixon and moving to advance the war on drugs. And, you know, I was a Vietnam War draft resister. And so at age 18, I decided that I would drop out of college and focus on getting balanced through the use of LSD and other psychedelics, and then commit myself as kind of a revolutionary, evolutionary strategy to bringing back psychedelics. So it was just a decision at age 18. I identified myself as, you know, a counterculture drug-using criminal. I anticipated going to jail for being a draft resister. You know, I was using marijuana and LSD. And so the arc of my life, now I'm almost 62 next month, and I don't feel that I'm counterculture anymore. I'm still a drug user, and I'm still in some senses a criminal, but I really don't think of myself as a kind of a criminal. I think of myself as, you know, a patriotic American trying to undo laws that shouldn't be there in the first place. So the decision at age 18 in 1972 was something that predated 10 years later when I finally went to college again to start my first year as a freshman, to continue my first year. And I went back to New College in Sarasota, Florida. And the first semester that I was back in school, New College is fantastic and you can do off-campus study. And so I arranged for my very first week, my first month actually in college, to go to Esalen, to Big Sur, and study with Stan Grof. And Stan is the world's leading LSD researcher, a theoretician, helped start transpersonal psychology, has taught holotropic breathwork. So I took this month-long workshop called The Mystical Quest. And who should come by but this woman, Debbie Harlow, who wasn't in the workshop, but she started talking about MDMA. And it was still legal at the time. And so I thought the way she described it, it wasn't very interesting. You know, I was used to fireworks and all sorts of stuff going off when you do LSD and mescaline and classic psychedelics. And she said, oh, it just helps you talk to people, helps you feel love. And I was like, well, I feel love. I'm happy. I can talk to people. I saw a bunch of people taking it, and they sat around and just talked to each other. And I'm like, well, you take a bunch of LSD, you can't even talk. So, you know, how interesting can this drug be? But at least I was smart enough to buy some. And when I tried it with my girlfriend for the first time, it was profound. It was absolutely profound. And I was really happy, too, because I felt like I woke up to LSD right after the backlash. And here I woke up to MDMA before it was criminalized, but it was clear that it was going to become criminalized because it was already being sold in public settings as ecstasy, even though it was being sold in therapeutic circles under the name Adam. So I thought, okay, I have a chance to both learn about this. And then I learned that there was this underground psychedelic psychotherapy community that I thought had gone out of existence, but was just quiet and was doing psychotherapy with psychedelics, including MDMA, all over America, actually all over the world as well. Not a whole lot of people, but a bunch. So I thought, okay, this is something I want to get involved with. And so I started training and learning more about non-ordinary states of consciousness from Stan through holotropic breathwork, which was through hyperventilation. And I thought, okay, I'm a college student. I've got a lot of time. I'll just sort of take a class. I'll start preparing for this eventual lawsuit against the DEA. And then in the summer of 84, DEA decided to criminalize MDMA. And we had prepared, we'd done a secret study of the safety of MDMA and kept it quiet just for this moment. And so then I went to Washington and filed a request for a hearing. And Andy Weil had gone to college with a lawyer who was a part of a big Rick Hotton, who was part of a big DC law firm, Dewey Ballantyne, and they agreed to take the case for free as pro bono. So we sued the DEA, got involved with this lawsuit. I took a class suing the DEA, and everything else was, my classes were psychology and learning, getting all the requirements for a psychology major. But every semester I had a special class that I would make up with a professor on psychedelic psychotherapy or transpersonal psychology. And then we ended up winning the lawsuit against the DEA. Shockingly, you know, the DEA administrative law judge said that MDMA should be in Schedule 3, and the head of the DEA rejected that recommendation. And this was around the same time that there was lawsuits about marijuana, about medical marijuana. And the same judge said that marijuana was one of the safest therapeutic drugs known to man, and it should be Schedule 1. I mean, it shouldn't be Schedule 1. It should also be Schedule 3. And the DEA similarly rejected that. So we had a series of lawsuits now in the appeals court about what is the about why DEA rejected these recommendations. And DEA lost and lost. And then eventually they succeeded in coming up with a set of standards of how to determine what currently accepted medical use is that the appeals court accepted. And it basically was that these standards were almost identical with FDA standards for approving a drug. So in 1986, I realized that after, even though we won the DEA administrative law judge case about MDMA and other people, normal and others, won the case about marijuana, that really the only way to go through the system was to go through the FDA, that healing illness, doing science, that I felt like that was the sort of weak link in the prohibition system, that it's really hard to justify blocking science. And when you start talking about helping patients, it's not recreational use, it's not hedonistic. And so in 1986, I started MAPS. It does have the most syllables of any organization in the drug policy reform movement, the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, MAPS.org. I started it in 86 essentially as a nonprofit pharmaceutical company and to try to develop. And I think there was a similar misconception I had as some of the people at Normal had too, which was that there are so many people using these drugs that millions of people should be sending us $10 or $5, and we'll be able to fund all the research from, you know, large numbers of small donors. And I think what we misunderstood is that a bunch of people would rather spend more money on drugs than on political action. And I think they also didn't believe that the political action would work. I mean, this is Nancy Reagan and the escalation of just saying no. And so it was very hard to find the money, to find the donors. And now I think it's a lot easier in that respect. But so that's basically then the history of MAPS. Started in 86 while I was still a college undergraduate. And then when I tried to get into a clinical psych PhD program to learn to do research into psychotherapy outcomes with MDMA, nobody would let me in. It was just incredibly frustrating. This was before psychedelic research was opened up again. Nobody would let me in. So my plan since 1971 and 72, now this was 1987 and 88, and nobody would be a PhD program. So when I'm stuck with kind of conundrums and not sure what to do next, I have a strategy that they use a lot, which is to go off and smoke some pot and think about it in a different way. And so I had this thought that I want too much too soon. This is the society is saying, you know, no research. And I said, okay, the science is being blocked by the politics. And so maybe I have to go slower and study the politics and undo that. And I thought, okay, if I'm going to do that, I remembered a Harper's Magazine interview with a couple people, Mark Kleiman being one of them, who's a drug policy expert, and they mentioned our lawsuit against the DEA. And Mark was a professor at Harvard at the Kennedy School of Government. Now, I had only taken one public policy class as an undergraduate. It was suing the DEA. And so I called Mark up and I said, you know, my background is in psychology. I've only got this one public policy class, but I'd really like to study the politics. And, you know, if I could get into the Kennedy School, would you be my mentor? And he said, yeah, I would. I'd be glad to do it. And so I managed to get into the Kennedy School, and that led to this whole other long process where finally in 2001, I got my PhD from there. And that also changed my attitudes as to who I am. You know, am I really this counterculture criminal, or could I be part of the mainstream? And so I felt like, yeah, this transition that I'm trying to make, I think drug policy needs to be reformed, and the whole field can make that transition. So that's where we're at right now. And that's why, you know, you and I are talking about progress that we're making.
And we're talking about that on Political Perspectives, which is the program you folks are listening to. Political Perspectives on KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM on your radio dial, KBOO.FM on the web. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. We're speaking with Rick Doblin. He's the founder and director of the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. You've had a lot of success lately. I mean, perseverance has paid off. The trials for MDMA therapy you've got going on around the world, including in the United States. We've gone from just say no and don't even mention the name of a drug to being able to say the words harm reduction without having your grant proposal turned down, to be able to, to be able to get research using MDMA for post-traumatic stress disorder to treat PTSD. Now, before we go into the research, I want to ask you about some of those projects you've got going on. First, could you tell folks what is PTSD?
Good question. Post-traumatic stress disorder is a way in which people get trapped in the past. Something happens that's really traumatic. And the way our brains process information is altered. And it's because it's so traumatic, the memories don't get stored away, but they're sort of trapped. And that every time people are reminded of this incident, and a lot of things trigger those memories, they re-experience some of that fear and anxiety. And they can't get past it. They can't. It's like a meal that you can't really digest because it's so unpalatable. And they don't have that ability. They're sort of stuck. And then it comes out in their nightmares. Then they start avoiding things that remind them of the trauma. They have emotional numbing to try to not feel anything. A lot of them get involved into alcoholism and drug abuse to try to forget their problems. And it's as if this past event is continually occurring in the present. So they're stuck. And it can come from any number of different things. I mean, we've just completed a study of 24 people who are veterans, firefighters, and we even got a police officer with work-related trauma. And we've also done studies with women survivors of childhood sexual abuse or adult rape and assault, workplace accidents. So it doesn't, PTSD is a disease that can be caused by any number of different kind of traumatic incidents, car crashes, all sorts of things. And once you're into the disease, then the cause doesn't matter. It looks similar. For those people that are interested in neuroscience, there's a hyperactivation in the amygdala, the fear processing part of the brain, and a diminished activation in the frontal cortex, where we put things in context so that people are on this hair trigger for fear. And then MDMA is like the perfect drug for PTSD. It does the opposite. It reduces activity in the amygdala and increases activity in the frontal cortex. And it helps people to switch this memory out of sort of current memory to digest it and then put it into context and store it away. And what we find under MDMA is that people can remember the trauma even better. It's not like it helps people forget the trauma, that the fear that has caused certain memories to be suppressed is reduced. And so memories flood back and people remember more about the trauma, but they remember it when they're feeling safe and supported, both from the MDMA and from the male-female co-therapist team. That's the essence of our treatment approach. And when they are feeling safe and supported as the trauma comes up, and a lot of times they'll be shaking, they'll be shivering, they'll be terrified, but they're processing it. And then it can be put into long-term memory, and you can learn from it, but you're not burdened by it every day. And then people can start their lives fresh. And that's essentially what we're doing. Now, we also have recently got a $2.1 million grant from the state of Colorado for a marijuana study for post-traumatic stress disorder in 76 veterans, mostly Iraq and Afghanistan. But there's no age limit, so we can even take some Vietnam vets. And marijuana for PTSD is helpful for a lot of people because what it does is it suppresses dream recall. For me, that's the one negative side effect from smoking marijuana, that dream recall is reduced. And for people that are traumatized and have nightmares, that's a benefit. And then it also helps people focus on the here and now and focus on the present. So the weight of the past isn't so great. But it's a palliative treatment. It's something that people who use marijuana for PTSD tend to use it every day. And if they don't use it, the symptoms come back. So it's helpful, but it's not a cure. And you know, when it comes to mental illness, any other illness, different kind of patients are drawn to different kind of treatments. You need more treatment options for doctors and patients. So we feel that the MDMA is for very important, but it's not the only thing, and that marijuana can be helpful for PTSD. And we're also starting to look into ayahuasca, which is the psychedelic tea from the Amazon. There's a bunch of veterans who've gone down to the Amazon for treatment for PTSD with ayahuasca. You know, and eventually I think what we're talking about is psychedelic medicine. And for this discussion, I'll just include marijuana as a psychedelic. And so ideally we would have psychedelic medicine in the future. We'll have all these different drugs available to the therapists and doctors. And at some point they might say, hey, now's the time for example, we require everybody to taper off their psychiatric medicines to become eligible for receiving MDMA because there's the traditional psychiatric medications mute the effects of MDMA. So that's a 6-8 week process sometimes. And during that, people's symptoms come back. So maybe you could say, okay, taper off your medicines, but if you need to, you could smoke marijuana to keep your symptoms at bay because you only need to stop smoking marijuana a day or two before MDMA to have the full effect. Then we can give them MDMA a couple times. Then maybe you say, you know, now you've healed enough, you've learned about letting your feelings work. Maybe a more traditional psychedelic like LSD or psilocybin or ayahuasca would be helpful. And then maybe we'd end up with MDMA again to help people integrate the parts that were more difficult that came up under the traditional psychedelics. And then people might use marijuana or might not. So it's a whole field of medicine. And what we have right now is a psychiatry captured by the pharmaceutical industry with the basic idea that you can forget about talk therapy and just take these drugs and take them every day. And that's really unsatisfying and it doesn't work. It helps some people, but a lot of people it doesn't help and there's side effects. So the research has shown that when you combine pharmacotherapy with psychotherapy, your results are better. But that's still just usually looking at daily, you know, medications combined with psychotherapy. But MDMA, psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy, is that combination of non-drug psychotherapy punctuated every month or two, but not that often, with a psychedelic experience to bring things up. And then you spend weeks afterwards integrating it. And so I think that's the psychedelic psychotherapy is going to be extremely popular, I think, in the future. And in some ways, it's like an anti-drug approach. You know, the idea is not to have somebody feel like their mental health is dependent upon taking a pill for the rest of their life. Their mental health is dependent upon going through these deep experiences that help them process these different memories. And then they can move forward independently and feel more free. And I should add that there's other studies that we're doing. MDMA for autistic adults with social anxiety at Harvard-UCLA. That's getting really good results in a preliminary way. We're getting good preliminary results from a study in San Anselmo with MDMA for people with a life-threatening illness who are anxious about dying. We're about to start a study with some VA-affiliated therapists. It's couples therapy where one of the couple has PTSD. And we're very interested in couples therapy too, because that's one of the best uses of MDMA. But it's not a disease, you know, so we can only go through the medical model for diseases. And so there's the FDA will never approve a drug for couples therapy. But here it is now where we get to do some studies in couples therapy with, but it's focused on the one person of the couple that has the PTSD. So there's all sorts of research going on. I just got an email today from people who want to do some research with tinnitus, ringing in the ears, that MDMA seems to help. Sometimes, you know, not so much permanently, temporarily, but now they're talking about combining MDMA with a certain kind of non-drug therapies for tinnitus. There's going to be an enormous range of different uses of MDMA and of psychedelics, because for everything that psychotherapy is for, these drugs can be used to enhance that process.
It's some fascinating stuff. Now, is I was looking at the Veterans Administration website. They have a section on PTSD, not surprisingly. Here we go. Recent data from the National Comorbidities Survey Replication indicates lifetime PTSD prevalence rates are 3.6% and 9.7%, respectively, among American men and women. So just less than 4% of all American men and just less than 10% of all American women during their lifetime will suffer from PTSD. Those are really big numbers. I mean,
staggering.
Do you think that's an understatement, or do you think that sounds about right?
No, I think that sounds about right. And I think that's terrible. I mean, let's just talk a little bit too about global politics. So for example, if, you know, we don't actually have a war on American soil. I mean, we had 9/11, but if you go to places like Syria or like Israel or like Egypt or Lebanon, Jordan, Rwanda, I mean, you look all over the world, those numbers are low. I mean, there are places where war and refugees have tends to, you know, incredible. So, and then people are looking more and more at what's called multi-generational trauma. So that if your parents are traumatized, a lot of times they pass that on to the kids. I mean, the kids, you know, learn to react in a hyper-fearful way. There's even epigenetics that suggest that if your parents are highly stressed when your mother is pregnant, that can be influencing the fetus. And then these people develop, you know, the fear of the other and of the outsider, and they're trained in that kind of hatred as well. So we get these repetitive cycles of multi-generational trauma that just go on for hundreds, sometimes thousands of years. And so how do we interrupt that? And I think psychedelic psychotherapy is one of the ways that can do that.
Again, you're listening to Political Perspectives on KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, KBOO.FM on the web. I'm Doug McVeigh, and we're speaking with Rick Doblin, founder and director of the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, a researcher who's been doing quite a lot of work with MDMA, with LSD, ayahuasca, even ibogaine. I want to find out more about some of the specific stuff you're doing with MDMA, but I also want to ask you about ibogaine. This is something that a lot of people should know about. Some people do know about. Let's talk about ibogaine for a moment. It's derived from a plant in Africa. It's been used underground in quite a few cases as a treatment for various addictions. I know people who've used it to get off of heroin. What kind of work are you doing with ibogaine, and what do you think of the stuff as a treatment for dependence?
Ibogaine has incredible potential. Ibogaine also has serious risks, and you know, people have died under the influence of ibogaine through what it does to the heart. So it should be used in a carefully supervised setting. One of the most important psychedelic experiences of my whole life was Ibogaine in 1985. And I feel like that experience, I still feel the benefits of it every day in terms of how it helped heal me from this constant, you know, self-criticism and linking that to self-hatred. And I've seen people make major transformations of their life through Ibogaine to get over addiction. But again, it's a drug that needs to be approached carefully. But when you do that, it can be administered safely. What we're doing is called an observational study. What you need to do research with is drugs that are purified to the extent that FDA or others accept them as standardized drugs. And Ibogaine has, it's a root from Western Africa. It's used in Gabon. It's used by the Bwiti religion. It's something that unusually helps people go through opiate withdrawal, and it gives them profound psychotherapeutic experiences where their repressed memories come up of what they're doing to themselves from their addiction, and then also gives often people a connection to ancestors, to spirituality. So what we're doing, because we don't actually have a purified supply of Ibogaine, we're looking at clinics. Ibogaine is it's a good example of the American drug war gone nuts. It was, you know, scheduled in the 60s. It's not a drug of abuse. People vomit. People have very difficult experiences, but productive. So it's never been a drug of abuse. And fortunately, most countries of the world didn't go along with the U.S. So Ibogaine is legal in Canada, legal in Mexico, legal in England, legal throughout Europe, most of Europe, and illegal in the U.S. So there are clinics that have been set up for opiate addicts and also sometimes for people who want personal growth all over the world. And so what we've done is say we need a little bit of science here, but we're not actually administering the Ibogaine. We're going to look at clinics and we're going to do observational studies of how they administer Ibogaine. And we're going to test people with a measure called the Addiction Severity Index, the ASI, which is a sort of gold standard for evaluating the consequences of addiction. And we're going to evaluate people at the baseline before they get treated, and then once a month for a year. And that's pretty good for a long-term follow-up. And we've done work with clinics in Mexico and clinics in New Zealand. And the research is being written up right now. We're getting it, preparing it for publication. It looks pretty promising. To give you a sense of how twisted American priorities have been, the National Institute on Drug Abuse refused to provide any funding for research with Ibogaine in the treatment of addiction, because it produced a psychedelic effect, and they didn't want to say anything positive about non-ordinary states of consciousness. Dr. Stanley Glick in New York developed a drug called 18-MC, which is a non-psychedelic Ibogaine. It's been tested in animals. It seems to reduce craving. It doesn't have the psychological effects. And so NIDA refused to research to support research with Ibogaine, but gave a for-profit company a $6.5 million grant to study 18-MC, which has never even been used in humans. And so, and not only that, but they didn't say, okay, this is government money, you know, we'd like a part of your company for the public. They said, no, we're just going to give you $6.5 million for your for-profit company to go ahead and research 18-MC. And if it turns out you just make all the money, that'd be great. And that's only because it's not psychedelic. And it's very doubtful to me that it will work as well as Ibogaine. So I guess what I'm also saying here is that, you know, it costs a lot of money to do clinical trials. We're mostly focused on MDMA for PTSD. You know, we anticipate phase three is going to cost $22 million or so. So we have about half of it in hand or pledged. So I think we'll be able to raise the other half. But the issue is, how are we, you know, going to move forward with research with Ibogaine, with research with ayahuasca, with all these other drugs? And you know, we just have to, you know, do what research we can to show that it's helpful, and then rely on both larger, you know, as many small donors, but then also larger donors. And so I think once we publish these papers in a peer-reviewed journal that's well-known for, you know, papers on alcohol and drug abuse, I think the interest in Ibogaine will grow. And hopefully more people will step up and say, we want to see this. And maybe eventually, I think, you know, we talked a little bit before about how you're able to go down to the corner store and buy marijuana now in Oregon. I think that as this the zeal for the drug war and for mass incarceration diminishes, hopefully we'll see increased public support for research with Ibogaine and MDMA and LSD and psilocybin and marijuana. And so I think our Ibogaine project, you know, for me, the sad thing in a way, amazing, is that there's been clinics that have been doing this for 25 years, but no, there's a little bit of a tendency to talk about psychedelics as a one dose miracle cure. And that's the way some of the Ibogaine advocates were. You take Ibogaine, you know, you do go through your withdrawal process, and then you're not addicted anymore in that way. But there's still these psychological factors. And so a lot of people relapse after Ibogaine. And what we're trying to figure out is how to support that initial opening. And I think that this studies that we'll publish will show that it does help some people, and that we should be, as a culture, switching from the criminal justice approach to stigmatizing and making it more dangerous for those people that use these drugs. We should make it less dangerous and provide, you know, supportive psychotherapy and addiction treatment on demand and all of that. And so hopefully that's what our Ibogaine study will help contribute to the growth of that movement.
That's terrific. I mentioned that a friend of mine, I saw the friend doing the Ibogaine therapy. It was went on a few days, and it was effective for a time. But as you say, there are a lot more factors than just the physical addiction. And after a few months, he relapsed. And I think he's doing better now. But still, it's what you said. It's not a magic bullet.
Yeah, I wonder, though. I mean, what we're trying to say to some of these clinics, too, is it would be good for you to think about it as, you know, multiple sessions over time. So let's say that a couple months goes by, he's starting to feel like, you know, it's helped, but, you know, the pull of drugs is coming back. That'd be a time for another session. And then when you think about it like that over time, you know, we don't need if we had a one dose miracle cure, that'd be the best, but that's not realistic. So although who knows, maybe science will come up with it, but still, I think that seeing this as we do with the MDMA for PTSD, that you have these psychedelic experiences, but they're encased in a larger larger therapeutic support system. And one of the reasons we don't have that with Ibogaine is precisely because it's illegal in the U.S. So people need to go away from where they live to get Ibogaine. Then they come back into their normal environment, and they're exposed to all the same pressures and stresses and temptations. And if they could have Ibogaine clinics throughout the United States, I mean, you know, the number of people that are dying from opiates in Massachusetts, it was front page, today's paper in the Boston Globe. You know, it's all over the place. People, you know, the number of people that are dying from opiates is massive. And so one of the tragedies of the drug war is that we've criminalized Ibogaine, which is not a drug of abuse, and we've forced people to go abroad for treatment, and then, you know, they don't have the kind of support services that they need after the treatment.
You need sort of, it almost that it harks back to Norman Zinberg and his drug set and setting. It's not just the drug, it's not just the mindset, but it's also the setting in which the person lives, in which they use. I mean, take the person put them at this wonderful resort where they can hang out and have tension and therapy and work out, and it's almost like a wonderful spa. And then, you know, a month later, they're healthy, they're ready. They go back to the misery that they were in, the life and the pace and the rest, and suddenly they're back using again. And it's and we wonder why that, and we wonder why the success rates aren't higher.
Yeah, you know, interestingly enough, I just ran into Dorothy Zinberg, Norman's widow, his wife, just 2 days ago, actually, a few days ago. Well, actually, it was Saturday, so almost a week ago. Yeah, she's doing well. She's still a professor at the Kennedy School of Government. I think Norman really was a pioneer in this area. And I think that points to one of the fundamental problems of the drug war, which is that we have somehow or other invested drugs. There's good drugs or bad drugs, and they have all these properties. And, you know, the bad drugs we make illegal, and the good drugs, you know, pharmaceutical companies can sell. But what we've ignored by that is that it's about the relationship that you establish with the drug, whether it's beneficial or harmful. So it's not about this is a bad drug or this is a good drug. It's how it's used. And that's really one of the most fundamental misconceptions of the drug war, is to sort of demonize certain drugs, you know, as a way to demonize the people that chose to use them. And so I think if we can get back to that idea that we can have positive relationships with all different things, but according to their particular properties and risks and benefits, then we develop different kinds of contexts. And that's what Norman Zinberg was talking about so long ago. And it's only now more people are starting to really appreciate that.
Let's turn for a moment to the assassin of youth, at that old devil weed, marijuana. We talked about it briefly. You wrote your master's thesis based on a survey you did of oncologists regarding smoked marijuana versus the oral synthetic THC pill for nausea control. You've been working on this for a very long time. Now, not long ago, you were working up in Massachusetts with Dr. Lyle Craker, I think, to try and get some research done on marijuana. What else happened? What's happening with marijuana research in you?
Okay. Well, several things. So back in, you're right. So my thesis was a survey of doctors, and this was 1990. And that was at a time when you couldn't get permission to do actual research. So this was a way, a survey, where I could do, I could gather information. And it showed that a lot of doctors thought that smoked marijuana was better than the oral THC pill, and that they preferred it for their patients, but it wasn't available. Then starting in 1991, I said, okay, I want to really do research with marijuana. And I couldn't find any doctor willing to try to go through the FDA. And then there was a woman, Brownie Mary, and she was a grandmother type in San Francisco, and she made marijuana brownies for people in the AIDS wards in the San Francisco General, and it helps with nausea and it helps with appetite. And she was at her dealer one day, dealer meaning somebody who donated the shake and leaves and other things to her, and the dealer got busted, and she got busted too. And it was national news, you know, grandmother Brownie Mary gets arrested on this compassionate mission. And she was from San Francisco General, from UC San Francisco. So I thought, okay, I'm going to call some people there and see if they'd be willing to do research. And I said, you've got a moral obligation. This woman who is now facing jail, you know, shouldn't you try to do some research to show that marijuana can be helpful to AIDS people? And I met a Dr. Donald Abrams, who was one of the leading AIDS researchers, and he said he was willing to try to do some research. So Donald and I started, and we got FDA approval, we got all the IRB approvals, and NIDA refused to provide us with the marijuana for the study. It was super frustrating. And then 1996 happens, and we have California and Arizona passing the first two medical marijuana initiatives in the state level. And NIDA realized that one of the reasons people are voting for these initiatives that basically says, you know, forget the FDA, we're just going to make it legal by the state, is because the route through FDA approval was politically blocked. So NIDA realized that they had a problem. So in discussions with Donald, they said, if you switch your study to look at the risks of marijuana in AIDS patients, don't look at AIDS-wasting patients, We'll give you the money for the study and we'll give you marijuana. So we had a bunch of discussions and decided that, yes, that he should accept that and that you could sort of smuggle in some research into the benefits into a study of the risks. It's your secondary objectives. You look at appetite and weight gain. And what he showed was that marijuana did not cause any kind of problems with the protease inhibitors, drug-drug interactions, and that it did help increase appetite and increase weight gain. So it was tremendously successful. Then I started working with Ethan Russo, who we did a study. We got permission from FDA and IRB for a marijuana migraine study. Same story. NIDA refused to sell us the marijuana. It was really, really frustrating. And then Dale Geringer from California Normal and I started working together on a study with marijuana and water pipes and vaporizers. And we did the first study with water pipes and vaporizers, and we showed that water pipes, you look at the bong water and you think, wow, they must be doing an awful lot of filtering of bad stuff. But it turns out water pipes filter as much cannabinoids as they do gunk. And so the smoke that comes on the other end has the same ratio of cannabinoids to particulate matter as the smoke that goes into the water. So, but vaporizers heat the marijuana up. They don't burn it. And they're a non-smoking delivery system that's less carbon dioxide, stuff like that. But we got marijuana from LV Musica, one of the compassionate care patients that received marijuana from NIDA. We kind of redirected it in ways that pissed some people off, but nobody got in trouble. So then we tried to get marijuana from NIDA to continue that research. And we spent 7 years trying to buy 10 grams of marijuana, and NIDA refused to sell it to us. All right. So what I recognized in 2000 was that there was two fundamental obstacles to making marijuana into a medicine. One was we had to end the NIDA monopoly, which blocks research. The other was we had to introduce vaporizers into clinical research, because I believe a rational risk-benefit analysis will approve smoked marijuana. Smoked marijuana does not cause lung cancer. There's anti-tumor properties of the cannabinoids. Dr. Donald Tashkin from UCLA, who's the leading researcher on marijuana and lung function from NIDA, multiple decades of his career was spent at this. He was initially against the legalization of marijuana because he thought it caused lung cancer, but his research showed it didn't cause lung cancer. Now he's a proponent for marijuana legalization. So in any case, there was these two fundamental things we had to overcome. We have gotten vaporizers accepted by FDA, the Volcano vaporizer, in clinical research through Donald Abrams. And we also, with Lyle Craker, starting in 2001, submitted an application to DEA to get a license to grow marijuana. And, you know, DEA did all sorts of horrible things. They did nothing for multiple years. We had to sue them in the Court of Appeals under the Administrative Procedures Act for unreasonable delay. The judge said to the DEA, it's not necessarily unreasonable delay for you to do nothing for 3.5 years, but you have to explain why you're doing nothing. So then they decided, all right, we're going to reject this application. And then once they rejected it, we sued them in the administrative law judge hearings. And yet again, we won. The judge said it should be in the public interest for there to be multiple producers of marijuana. DEA rejected that. And we lost in the appeals court in 2013. Well, circumstances have changed. And now, actually, earlier today and the last couple of weeks, we're working on a new application from Professor Craker. And we believe this time there's a really good chance that the DEA will say yes. There was just hearings in Washington, D.C., at which Nora Volkov, the head of NIDA, said that the NIDA monopoly should end. A senior FDA official said the same thing. October 15th, just a few days ago, there was a letter that was sent to Senator Elizabeth Warren, the Massachusetts senator. She and other senators have sponsored what's called the CARES Act to try to promote research with medical marijuana. So this was a letter that came from the head of the DEA, the head of ONDCP, the drug czar, and the head of HHS, saying they're looking at ways to end federal obstruction of medical marijuana research. It was somewhat hopeful. And so I believe that in the next month or so, we're going to submit a new application with Professor Craker to DEA to get a license to grow marijuana exclusively for federally regulated research. And at the same time, you know, we do have this marijuana PTSD study that, you know, after being frustrated for refusing to provide the marijuana for Donald's study into the benefits of marijuana, refusing to provide marijuana for Ethan Russo's, about 6 years ago, I said, all right, maybe I'll try again. And we thought, okay, you know, we're developing an expertise of MDMA for PTSD. Let's do a look at marijuana for PTSD in veterans. And so it's taken us 6 years. We have all the approvals. NIDA's agreed to, well, almost all the approvals. NIDA's agreed to sell us the marijuana. The only thing we're waiting on is DEA approval. And DEA is really just waiting for us to remodel the facility in Phoenix, Arizona, where Dr. Sue Sisley will conduct half the study. The other half of the study is going to be conducted at Johns Hopkins under the direction of Ryan Vandry, who's a PhD researcher there, with Marcel von Miller being the coordinating principal investigator. So we are about, after roughly 25 years of trying, are now finally able to start the first medical marijuana drug development study with the marijuana plant smoked. And there's a Canadian company, Tilray, that produces medical marijuana, owned by Privateer, a venture capital firm. And Tilray said, hey, we want to do some research too. You know, could we use your protocol? And we said, sure, we're a nonprofit drug development, take our protocol. And so they're doing a study with marijuana for PTSD, but they're using their marijuana rather than NIDA marijuana. And they're using vaporization instead of smoking. So we'll combine the data, see how it works. So that's basically where it's at. We're you know, we have this $2.1 million grant from the state of Colorado. There's the possibility that we're going to get a grant to help study medical marijuana in Israel. There's, you know, Israel is one of the leaders of medical marijuana in the world. And we're hopefully going to get our own license to grow. And so we could consider nonprofit drug development of marijuana. I mean, one question is, why bother? You know, all these states are going to legalize, patients can just get it. There's all these medical marijuana patients, but there's a lot of information that we don't really know. What's best for what? What does CBD do? What does THC do? What do the terpenes do? What do the other cannabinoids do? And then the other big part is that medical marijuana patients have to buy their marijuana. Insurance companies aren't paying it. And once, if we can take it through the FDA, then insurance companies will cover it. So I think we're sort of moving in that direction. And by January 2016, we anticipate starting the study with marijuana for PTSD. And then hopefully by the end of that year, we'll have our own farm.
What a difference a few decades can make. This is Political Perspectives on KBOO Radio, KBOO.FM, 90.7 FM on your radio dial. I'm Doug McVeigh, and I'm speaking with Rick Doblin, the director and founder of the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, or MAPS. On the web at maps.org. Good thing, such a long name, and you've got such an easy-to-remember URL. Nicely done.
I wish they would have got maps.com, though. I should have done that. I could have sold that for all sorts of money for MAPS. But we were like the number 600 or 700 website in the world. And it was pretty funny because this guy calls up and he says, you know, this is like 1993, 94. He says, I want to help you guys. You know, I've found MDMA was really helpful to me, and I want to help you. And I said, great. What do you want to do? He said, well, I'd like to give you a website. And I said, what's a website? So I didn't know, you know, maps.org, that's all we got. But if we got maps.com, we could have sold that for $1 million. The main things that I should say to leave people is that we've started the first study of MDMA for post-traumatic stress disorder in 2000. And it's been basically 15 years of pilot studies with MDMA for PTSD. And now we are ending these international series of phase two pilot studies. In December, we'll be collecting the final primary outcome data. And then what we're going to be doing is submitting all of this to the FDA in February or March for what's called an end of phase two meeting. And that's for this transition to phase three. So in terms of FDA, phase one is your first stuff in healthy normals. Phase two is your first studies in patients. And then those are just exploratory studies. But phase three are the large scale, randomized controlled, double blind studies that are called pivotal studies. Those are the ones that are used to make drugs into medicines. And we need to have two large scale phase three studies. So the really big thing that we're doing is preparing to summarize all of this data from 15 years, and not just our data, but data from other people as well. If you go to Medline, which is the repository of scientific literature, and you put in MDMA or ecstasy, there's over 5,000 papers, we estimate, at a price of over $300 million, mostly funded by other governments, looking at the risks of MDMA. But it helps us understand the risks of MDMA. So we need to summarize all of that, negotiate with FDA, and come up with the design of phase three. And that's what we think is going to be taking us through 2016. In early 2017, we hope to start phase three and be done and have MDMA approved as a prescription medicine by 2021. That's our current plan. We'll really know how realistic that is once we start negotiations with FDA.
Oh, again, brilliant stuff. This is Political Perspectives, KBOO Radio. I've been speaking with Rick Doblin. He's the founder and director of the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. And you can find more about his work and their research at MAPS, that's MAPS.org. Rick, thank you so very much for your time today.
Thank you, Doug. I really feel this public education is crucial for keeping public support there for the research that we're trying to do. So thank you too, Doug.